Start recording now. Impedes resistance capacitance network, and we fall off the end and I don't get to networks, but I'll do it on the board in the good old fashioned way, okay? All right, so in the last lecture, have your attention please. Sorry again about this massive interruption, but my life got worse yesterday afternoon. The university started logging, obviously booting me off the system progressively and for no unknown reason that I can determine. Anyway, so from Kirchhoff voltage laws, we drew up this circuit, and it's the key to figuring out impedance and how to understand circuits at radio frequency. Okay, and I drew that diagram. We're going to go through that diagram step by step today. Let's summarise. I think we did a lot in the last lecture, and you probably don't know why unless we did it or what it was at all. The first rule we looked at charge inside metal. Get a charge, try to put it inside a metal. How long does it last for before it dissipates and races to the outer surface and sits on the edge? Okay? The answer is 10 to the minus 19 seconds. And that's true under any condition. Except, of course, for gamma ray photons, which we're not concerned with. So in this course, no charge ever appears inside a metal. That was the first thing. That was quite a simple result. It took us a bit of pain to get it, but it was a simple result. The next thing we looked at was skin depth. Well, we've now banished charges. Can we banish currents and electric fields from conductors? And the answer is not quite. They almost can. They're almost banished towards the edge, but they can actually live within a small distance given by the skin depth. And this was the formula for the electric field penetrating the wire or the conductor. Now, in this course, again, we've learnt Maxwell's equations by the integral forms, not the differential forms. So we're going to like situations in which symmetry exists in order to use them. Otherwise, the integral formulae are useless, except pictorial or for intuition. Intuition and symmetry is when they're useful. So here we're relying on the fact that the skin depth is so small that this is a flat surface. Even our 0.1 millimetre wire is a flat, infinite surface on which we can walk around and assume that the only variation is inward toward from the surface. Okay, so Z is there's a picture of it. That's the picture of the skin effect. Redone, you can see delta is that distance. The electric field at the top is an incident electromagnetic wave. There's a metal, an air-metal interface. A current is immediately induced on the surface of the conductor. In fact, that current is responsible for shielding the electric field. You can think about that current as being a secondary antenna, and it's responsible for launching the wave that opposes the incident electric field and prevents it coming into the metal. Entering the metal, and I've drawn there in light green a picture of what the electromagnetic wave looks like when it penetrates the metal. It decays very rapidly. The amplitude is on the horizontal axis for that little green diagram, if you like. And remember, it also propagates. That was a propagating formula we had up with. So this thing is not just oscillating in a standing wave fashion, it's actually moving into the conductor as well. And you can see that from that 1 plus JZ term there. Alright, so much for skin effect. Then we used that same formula to define the impedance per square. Okay, and the impedance per square ZS is just the electric field at the surface of the conductor, whatever that happens to be in the end. I called the electric field at the surface the incident electric field, but it's really the sum of the incident and the reflected one, the secondary electric field caused by the oscillating current. In its attempt to keep the tangential component of the electric field zero. But of course the electric field is not quite zero if there's finite conductivity. We're left with EY. If we divide that by the surface current, the current per unit width along the conductor, that is the current integrated in Z, but per unit width. So remember, current was inside, but we were looking at current density, which is current per metre squared or per unit area. And if we integrate entirely out in the depth, then we're just left with the current per unit width, and that's IS. And that comes to this simple formula, which is the impedance per square. And you can see that for thick conductors, that is where the skin depth is much less than the radius of the wire, for example, this surface impedance has equal amounts of resistance and reactance. They're always equal. Unfortunately, they're also frequency dependent because of the F in there, so it's dispersive. It's actually pretty useless for practical purposes, and we're going to see how to solve that problem in a minute in order to make a resistor. And now if you consider a wire of radius A, where A is much bigger than delta and of length L, then the actual impedance of that wire, internal impedance now, I should have had a subscript on that, is equal to L over 2 pi A times ZS, and some of you were struggling to understand that in the first question in the notes, in the web notes, the exercises. Alright, so the voltage source. Let's start with Kirchhoff's voltage law. How do we think about these things? Well, the voltage source is actually the most complicated thing to think of, and we're not going to bother about it. I just assume that a voltage source is a voltage source. It's a symbol on a page. I don't care how it happens. In practice, they're kind of like very large capacitors that provide an infinite amount of charge to a circuit at a voltage. And of course, at radio frequency, you have to have a way of converting that into an oscillating voltage, that is your source. And so the way to do that, we'll learn about soon enough, we'll be looking at transistor oscillators in this course. But for the moment, let's just think of some circuit symbol that causes an oscillating voltage. What does it do? Well, it just generates an electromotive force, forcing positive charge, if you like, to the top of the source or the battery or the signal generator, and negative charges down to the bottom. That's all it is. And that will cause an electric field that points in the opposite direction to those arrows. So for all intents and purposes, this thing looks just like a capacitor. You can forget, if you like, the meaning of electromotive force in those arrows. Just think of it as some magic thing inside the source that causes the charge separation we need. And then the charges overflow and fall down the circuit, a bit like an overflowing dam. All right, so much for that. I'll say one little bit more about it if I don't get cut off at the end of the lecture, all you need to know in this course. Okay, so let's look at resistance. Resistance is, this is the simplest case. Let's suppose that we're at low frequency or extremely low conductivity so that the skin depth is infinite. Then in any practical resistor, the current will be uniformly distributed over the cross-section. Does everyone understand that? That's the one thing you should have understood from all your previous courses, that if you have a resistive material at low frequency, DC for example, then the current flows uniformly over the surface. That should be obvious from the equation we had before. Remember that, I'll just jump up and there are a few blank faces, but I'm not sure whether you're really blank or you're just stunned at me, looking at me. EY, up the top of the page there. If delta is infinite, then EY is a constant. Because the argument in the exponential there becomes zero. And so that means that the electric field has no dependence on Z, and that means that the current has no dependence on Z. No problem, Bob. No problem. Okay, let's go on. Everyone happy with that? Yes. Oh, right. Well, this is the one you do know then. Because we haven't got to the non-uniform case yet. I've sort of laid the groundwork for it. So you understand this one? Yeah, okay. All right, so not this one, but the one I was just talking about there, yeah. All right, so this will give us a very familiar formula. I want to tie a loose end here. Voltage equals J over sigma, because I just used the formula of Ohm's law, right? And then I multiply by capital L, which is the length of this resistor. So I have JL over sigma, and then I express J as I, the current entering this thing, which is not marked. Should put them under I is the current. Capital I is the current as you know it from all your former courses entering here. I over A gives you J because J is uniform, right? And so we have L over sigma A times I, which is resistance times I. We finally have Ohm's law, the simple Ohm's law, okay? But you, more usually you would have seen the definition of resistivity, which is 1 over sigma. That's another in, what would that one be? Not mohos per meter, got it.
Ohm meters?
Oh, ohm meters for resistivity. That's its unit, okay. So eta is the resistivity, because I'm reserving rho for another symbol later on, reflection coefficient. So eta equals 1 over sigma, just 1 over conductivity, a new parameter for you. If you've got the conductivity of copper, you immediately have its resistivity. So there we have, simple Ohm's law, right, let's forget about that. Now, the first thing that you're going to, I've been talking about skin effect, and we're going to say, well, that's all right for low frequencies, or large values of eta, or low values of sigma, but what about in the real world where you want to make a radio frequency resistor? What can you do to beat the skin effect? And the answer is you use metal films. So let's look at that case. Now this is more particular. A resistor, how can we make resistors for radio? At low frequency, delta is finite. That's our problem. And we know that if, when I say low frequency, by the way, I mean like up to a gigahertz of the normal resistor, where wavelength effects are still not important. But delta is finite, meaning it's important, that's what I'm implying by that, and it's of the order of the wire radius, let's say. Then the impedance becomes, even if it's on the order of the wire radius, which is still quite large for delta, then the impedance becomes inductive. And so you can't make a resistor. Okay? You can't make a resistor out of an inductor. Okay? However, if the wire thickness W is much less than delta, then the current density will be uniform over a skin. So let's have a film, a metal film here, around an air gap. That grey thing is air, and this is a metal film. Then we can still say that J over sigma equals electric field. That's still correct. But we can still say that I divided by that little film area, provided this thickness W is much less, that's W there by the way too, looks a bit like omega here for some reason, for the top fonts I'm using. This W is much less than delta, J is again uniform. So there's how you make a resistor for radio frequency. And why do you have to go to all this trouble? Well, have a look at this nice simple formula now. This 2 pi A is the circumference of this annulus, the annular film. W is its thickness, so 2 pi A W is the area of the annulus, and this formula is exactly the same as this, if you consider A to be the area, okay? So once again, it's both, this formula, there's no J in it anymore, no reactive term, no inductance, it's resistive, and it's frequency independent. Frequency got lost too. And I'll try and do something about that W to make sure it looks like that W and doesn't look like an omega, right? Okay, did you understand that? Yeah, you're fine now with that, yeah. Not much different, really. Just a little bit of trickery to overcome skin effect. All right, here's an easy one. Capacitors at low frequency. Okay, this should be a revision for most of you, I think. You've already seen Q equals CV. That's how capacitance is defined. The important thing for us is this definition of impedance, okay? So how do we get it? The impedance of a capacitor, I'll say what it is exactly on the next page. But let's look at the current flowing into this capacitor. There's some charge built up there and there's some current flowing on. The current is by definition the integral of JdA, because I'm going to take the other surface, it's a closed integral, I'll take the other one right through the middle of the plates where there's no current. So the integral of JdA, that must give you dQ dt because of charge conservation. But we'll just substitute in. Capacitance is not changing with respect to time. Okay, so it's a geometrical parameter. And so we got dV dt, and then I'll substitute minus J omega for the ddt, and we end up with our classical formula, J omega Cv. Okay, no problems with that. For a parallel plate capacitor, we can go a bit further than that. We've defined QS as now the charge per unit area on the plate. So epsilon naught, epsilon R, QS over D, where QS is the charge per unit area. I've already derived that in an earlier lecture. And so capacitance of a parallel plate with a dielectric of relative permittivity epsilon R, or relative dielectric constant epsilon R,
A is the area, and D is the separation of the plates, could do with a few labels, I'll fix that. Then it's epsilon naught, epsilon r, A over D. Who's seen that before? You might have already seen it in the lab notes, yeah? It's one of the first things you do. That's for a simple parallel plate. And it's a very useful formula, epsilon naught, epsilon r. Let's just do a number, a calculation. Let's suppose, typical thing, you'll have a circuit board, right? FR4, fiberglass circuit board. I should have brought one along if you haven't seen one before. A double-sided board with a copper plate at the top and a copper plate at the bottom. Okay, let's suppose it's just 1 centimetre, so that's 10 to the minus 2 metres. So it has an area of 10 to the minus 2 squared. Multiply that by epsilon naught. Must always have the free space permittivity there, 8.85 by 10 to the minus 12. Dielectric constant, I think it's maybe about 5. Relative dielectric constant of fiberglass. Divide that by D. Well, D can be like about 0.3 of a millimetre, which is 0.3 by 10 to the minus 3. What does that give us? That's A, can I do that correct? So 5 eighths about 50 by 10 to the minus 4 by this 0.3 is a 3 by 10 to the 3, I'll move it all up into the numerator, times 10 to the minus 12. So that's 150 picofarads for something that's 1 centimetre. Well, that's too much. Yes, yeah, so that's 1 centimetre, right, 0.01, that's right, 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 12, 5, oh, it's 0.3 millimetre though. That's right, 0.3 millimetre, epsilon naught, epsilon r, a, over there, that's right. Yeah. Oh no, sorry, 15 puff. I crossed out the 0 there, 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the 3, 15 picofarads. Alright, sorry. Give us a heart attack, man. With 150 with that kind of capacitance, we'd be teaching audio people to do RF, right? Correct. A bit of circuit board that big that you're going to put your circuits on, that's what capacitance is worth from the top to the bottom plane per centimetre squared. Gigantic. Who can tell me off the top of their head what 15 picofarads into the gigabit? What impedance? Oh, I haven't told you what it is yet. Let's get impedance next. Next view graph. Righto, the impedance of a capacitor is 1 over J omega C. Valid for capacitor itself, provided that the component is physically small compared to wavelength. Otherwise, we have a resonant cavity. Those two plates then become a joke, right? But the whole thing becomes a resonant cavity with waves, bending waves all over the place, and all this theory breaks down. So all our capacitors are going to be small, no problem there. Resistors and capacitors suffer from other physical limitations, and I'll talk about those now. All right, 1 over J omega C. Can anyone, 15 picofarads, 1 gigahertz, how big is that? In impedance. I don't know what it is offhand myself, but 2 from 1. I get about 10 ohms. Is that right, Luke? 10 ohms?
Not good.
It's 1 over 2 pi. It's 6 by 10 to the 9 by 15 by 10 to the minus 12. So put the 10 to the 3 in the numerator. And so it's 6 by 15, yeah, which is 90, so about 100. 1,000 over 100. 10 ohms. 10 ohms! It's much lower than the characteristic impedance of coaxial cable. Okay, be careful of the print circuit boards. All right, let's get on now. I've still a lot to go, even with my truncated lecture. All right, is this right? Righto. This is the real important one. I've talked about internal impedance so far. We've learned about skin effect. We've learned how to make resistors at radio frequency. But all that pales in comparison to the effect of external inductance, okay? And this is quite insidious. theoretically. What happens is you have a current in a wire that oscillates. That current, by Ampere's law, produces a magnetic field that's all over the room, everywhere. Okay, we're going to see. In particular, for now, we are interested in that part of the magnetic field that links the circuit in which that current is flowing. In other words, the magnetic field turns around on its own circuit and introduces an electromotive force. So imagine that there's this current. The current causes a magnetic field. I've always drawn it in blue, so no sort. Like that, the field lines go around the conductor like this. In fact, I've got some there, these blue ones here. You can see that this is a copper wire, all with the enamel stripped off. And this is the arrow pointing in the direction of the current. And there are these magnetic field lines. And then there's a contour. And you can see that what we're going to be using here, if you're getting good at Maxwell's equations now, it's Ampere's law. That'll give you the magnetic field from the current. So these magnetic field lines, if we consider this to be the contour gamma, then the circulation integral of B dot dl equals mu naught I, where I is this current. And then we've got this magnetic field now linking the very circuit in which the current is flowing in the first place. And so the line integral of E dot dl over the curve C, which is now this curve, these are gamma, right, these ones. These other curves are gamma. The integral of over C around this one now of E dot dl is minus d phi b dt, where d phi b is the magnetic flux. It's the integral of the magnetic field over that area. In other words, Ampere's law, then Faraday's law, all acting together. In actual fact, we proved that electromagnetic waves propagated as waves because of the interaction of those two laws. So now what we're doing is almost the same thing. We have a circuit in which this is important because remember that that current was supposed to be caused by the very electromotive force we're now trying to derive. This is wave motion coming back against us, or maybe not, but anyway. However, the current in a circuit induces a magnetic field outside which acts back on the circuit through Faraday's law. That's what inductance is. When a circuit behaves like that, we call it an inductor, and they all do. Not only that, inductors are there with you wherever you go at radio frequency. You can't get rid of them. You can't walk into a lab where they don't exist. All right, so let's have a look at this. Let's picture what's happening here. First of all, you may know that inductors, when you see them in the shop, are always little coils of wire somehow, aren't they? They're always wound up into a coil. So an inductor is a coil of wire in which the magnetic flux is bunched up. It's a wire that's meant to concentrate Faraday's law into a little region. And you can see the way it works. Imagine that you get that coil and just stretch it out. What's going to happen to the magnetic flux? Well, those magnetic field lines weave around the wire, linking it multiple times. In fact, if there are n turns on that coil, that the magnetic flux will do n trips around the stretched out wire. Can you see that sort of topologically? It's only a topological argument, this, because unfortunately, you change the magnetic field's magnitude by stretching a wire out like that, because after all, it's caused by the current in the wire. And the current in the wire produces a very different magnetic field here to here, even the same value of current. But anyway, it's good for pictorial purposes, because you can now plainly see. If I go back to view graph number one in a frenzied up jump, you can see that what we're saying here is here's a coil of wire. This is where most of the magnetic field is linking the circuit. But let's face it, if we're real, we'd admit that there's plenty due to the rest of this circuit. Okay. And now if we do our trick on this inductor and spread it out, we'll see this multiple linking occur. And we realise all of a sudden that the inductor, the coil, is nothing but doing what the rest of the circuit is trying to do, but it's probably better at it. That's all it's doing. But we don't get rid of inductance, in other words, by stretching an inductor out and making it a wire. We don't get rid of it. It's still there. So we have to learn how to handle inductance. We have to know how to minimise it. Or actually, what you really do is you live with it. And we'll show how that happens. All right, so there it is. Now, this is the important bit. This is where we get back to
time. We've looked at internal impedance, now we're looking at external impedance. Here's our conductor. We integrate Faraday's law on the contour outside the wire. So I'm deliberately going to, whereas before we were studying surface impedance in this tiny little region here of skin depth, and we had one impedance there, we now have a completely new impedance where we take the contour. Well, how far out do we go is the question. And that's a good question. How far out do you go? For the moment, I'm not going to say how far this contour goes away from the wire. We'll just live with it for 1 second. All right, but there's the magnetic field lines. Remember, the current's going that way, so these magnetic field lines are actually in a circuit around this this conductor. And obviously, if we can calculate that magnetic field and we know the frequency of the current, then we can integrate over that area using Faraday's law to find the electromotive force, in other words the E field, on that contour, just by Faraday's law. Okay, that's all it is. Well, let's see just that simple knowledge without actually doing the calculation leads us to a new result. It's not new for you, but it's sort of a new way of presenting it, I think. To obtain an expression for the magnetic field, you use Ampere's law. We neglect displacement current in a small circuit. I won't go into the details about that. I did write Ampere's law up over here without the EDT term. But it's also negligible here for a similar reason that it was inside a metal. Since the current I is the same everywhere in the circuit, that's fundamental here as well, then the magnetic field in the space surrounding the wire is going to be given something like this expression. There's the current, it's proportional to the current, and there will be a geometric factor, g of x, where x is a spatial coordinate, and g is a vector that points in the direction of the magnetic field. Now forget about g, I'm not going to derive it, I don't need to. Righto, here's Faraday's law, we plug this in, we're now integrating the magnetic field around the contour, the contour's name is gamma, that was the dotted contour in the previous view graph. DIDT. Well, remember that in Faraday's law there's a dBdt. Well, G doesn't vary with time, that's a geometrical effect. In this course we do not move our circuits, we keep them still. We have enough trouble with their stationary, just do one thing. So it's I that varies in time. The current has to be varying, that's where the dBdt comes from. The magnetic field varies instantaneously in response to the current, and so it's dIdt. Now that integral of Gx dA, that magic thing, is L, the inductance, or self-inductance. Once again, you take the time derivative, you end up with a very familiar formula, J omega Li. And what a complicated thing L has to be, and it's always there. An oscillating current in a circuit induces an electromotive force given by that for monochromatic oscillations, because I only have one omega, that's all I mean by that. In other words, you have to go back to LDIDT if the function of time is more complicated than a sine wave. Alright, so let's give a particular example. Inductance is sometimes referred to as self-inductance, and you'll see why in a minute. This is self-inductance because the circuit's doing it to itself, but it can also do this electromagnetic force thing into other circuits as well, introducing voltages in those. And the most important one you'll ever have to know is Grover's formula. I think everyone should have a copy of Grover. It makes good reading on holidays, but that formula there describes a situation where that curve, remember I said to you how far to the y, from the y you had to go? It goes to infinity. That curve goes to infinity. But the beauty of that formula is that if you've got a lump of, like a cylindrical length of conductor that you want to make a circuit out of, then you use that formula to calculate its inductance. You don't particularly care what that means, because a curve that goes to infinity doesn't interest anyone, right? But then what you do is you take another curve with the current in the opposite direction and use that formula again, just add the results, and then bingo, your infinity's gone. Because you're integrating infinity in both directions, those cancel out the current going in the opposite direction. So it's actually not a silly result, it's a very useful formula. And Grover does the mutual inductance case as well, which I don't want to get onto here. My laptop won't come up. All right, but what we do know is we can now start to understand a little bit what's going on in our our web notes. Right, stray impedance. The two of you graphs on stray impedance. The first one, both component structure, in other words, how the manufacturer built the component, as well as the external circuit wiring, complicate the simple ideas of, even if we manage to build a chip resistor and a ceramic chip capacitor and an inductor, which work well with gigahertz, if you don't use them properly, external wiring will screw things up for you, okay? Careful scrutiny of the component geometry reveals hidden or stray impedances that are usually not negligible, okay, as you'll see. In fact, that little bit of print circuit board over there ought to make you wary about even the circuit boards on which you build your components. Alright, so a typical resistor looks like this, where the current is assumed to be uniformly distributed over the surface by whatever means, in order to make it have a perfect resistance, even at a gigahertz. But then we went to all that trouble, and this is a megohm resistor. Okay? Now, a megohm resistor, an RF signal is not going to have it going to a megohm resistor. There's a capacitance due to varying voltages at either end of that resistor reaching right across it. And guess what it's going to do? Okay, so not only that, if you have a very low value of resistance, a very low value for tough, because that means that you have to be very careful about getting rid of the internal impedance. The internal impedance is not insignificant, it's just that it's usually much smaller than the external impedance, which means that your initial headache is usually much better than the migraine, okay? So what happens in addition to that is you make this connection with the wires. You've got to have wires or you can't solder the thing. But chip resistors have large contacts on them on which you can solder them that are no thicker than your usual wire, and then have the resistor itself in order to minimise inductance. But on a normal day, there's an L there and an L there. They're pretty much symmetric. And that there turns out to be a model of a resistor at radio frequency. Partly due to manufacturer's culpability and partly due to yours. That's the way it turns out to be. Partly unavoidable too. You'll find when you start soldering things on circuits, you can't ignore it. So what do? Take into account your calculations. Capacitors. The dielectric inside capacitors is the main problem there. It introduces resistance because no dielectric is perfect. And the more perfect they get, the more expensive they get. Teflon is very expensive. God knows. Is it $1,000 a kilogram? Teflon? That's very expensive. The same contact problem in connecting to these plates exists as for the resistor. So you've got an L. Okay? By the way, Not both of those L's are necessarily in that formula, obviously, but they're in series after all. Inductor. There's a coil, but that coil, there's a potential difference, you see, from there to there. And so there's a capacitor between the two coils. And that's the main problem of inductors. They also do have a resistance because they become antennas. Very easily become antennas, inductance coils. So you have this capacitance across them, and usually that's what you find happens. If you go up in frequency, you go through a parallel resonance, and the inductors become capacitive all of a sudden. That all make a bit more sense now. Okay. Alright, that's stray impedance number one. Stray impedance number two. Now this is on a more general level now. I've just exposed components, so you be wary about them and take them into account. The first exercise is on the web, but they give you an idea for how big the numbers are, basically. They don't just put one microhenry in front of everything you do in your life, because you never get through that way. But sometimes it will be 50 nanohenries, and it might be significant. But now suppose you've got the mere presence of an electric field now surrounding a circuit constitutes a capacitive coupling between adjacent components. So here's some hypothetical print circuit board here with some components. They've got voltages on them, so there's an electric field. It's very familiar to a floating shielding argument I made in an earlier lecture. The electric field line will terminate on those components. Those components now have a capacitor connected between them. I haven't drawn it there.
but you should see it, right? And you want to be careful about that. Why? Well, let's suppose one of those components happens to be at a point in the circuit with a very high impedance. Well, it may not be anymore, okay? And in fact, worse than that, you could imagine that that capacitor in the wrong place in a transistor circuit could turn a transistor amplifier into an oscillator. So it starts to oscillate, and nothing worse. The worst thing that one can do in RF is to build a power amplifier, to turn it on, sit back and watch it smoulder away because it destroyed itself when it oscillated. It was supposed to be a power amplifier. Okay, and that's the capacitive one. So capacitors can be stray, if you like, or parasitic. Additionally, the mere presence of a changing magnetic field in a circuit constitutes an inductive or mutual coupling between adjacent circuits. And this is where I realised that I missed out a new graph on mutual coupling for you, which I'll explain on the board right now. Okay? I think that's it. Oh no, I got started on it. Mutual coupling. Alright. Okay, first of all, are we clear about the meaning of stray or parasitic coupling now? We have two kinds of it. We don't really have two kinds, but because we like to think of our circuits as being made of components, we focus our attention on the components and we find them full of things that they shouldn't have. They're disease-ridden. Okay? The second thing is that when we build a circuit, at the circuit level now, we have a problem with mutual coupling. So if you're going to take parasitic effects, both capacitive and inductive or mutual coupling. And when you take a long circuit track on a circuit board carrying 500 megahertz and 1 amp, and it's going right around a sensitive preamplifier, forget about the sensitivity of that preamplifier. It's now preoccupied with amplifying a 1 watt signal when it meant it wanted to see a 1 picowatt signal. Okay. All right, so mutual coupling is like self-inductance. We're talking about mutual inductance here. If you have one circuit that reacts on itself by its own current, then certainly any neighbouring circuit will also pick up that same magnetic field, and Faraday's law says there'll be an electromotive force induced. I'll go straight to the result. I mean, you can sort of see it down here, my hastily drawn diagram from last night. These are the magnetic field lines of one circuit intercepting another. I should have a label on here indicating current I1 and I2. Okay? Alright, mutual inductance. The voltage induced in the first circuit is given by M times D I2 dt, where I2 is the current in the second circuit. And V2 equals M, the I1 dt. Who can notice something very interesting about those formulas? Yeah, it's the same. The mutual inductance of one circuit is the same for another. That's an important result, actually. I had a quick think about it, and I don't think I can prove it easily without being more general. We'll look at it later on. It's part of what's called reciprocity. And it happens even on larger spatial scales. Two antennas, one on this side of the Earth and one on the other side of the Earth. Put 100 watts into one antenna and you get 1 nanoamp out of the other antenna. Swap the power and the power generator and the current meter. Put 100 watts in the other antenna, you get 1 nano, exactly the same 1 nanoamp in the other antenna. Circuits are bilateral like that. Okay? And now, I think that's where I come unstuck. I might have to deliver this to you later. Yeah, I'm going to talk about Stevens off the end of the talk. However, the one other thing that I had to talk about, which I'll save it for the next lecture. That's fast, isn't it? Stupid bloke. It's fast too. Oh, okay, plenty of time. Right. Let's have a look at an application of mutual inductance, and I'm just going to draw the formula up. The most important is the transformer. Who has learned about transformers before? They're extremely important gadgets at RF. They're very versatile. Okay?
What is a transformer? A transformer, that's a transformer. Transformers come in all shapes and sizes. That's a perfectly viable one. That's one limit of a transformer. There are several limits. Another limit of a transformer are those mains transformers that they use in power supplies for mains operated equipment with transformer laminations and what have you. All right. Let's label this. V1, V2. So those voltages have the same sense. The transformer is nothing but two adjacent coils of wire that interact by a Faraday's law, mutual coupling. Okay? Let's let the current going into here be I1 and the current into here be I2. Then the equations, there are actually several ways of writing the solution mathematically given the self-inductance and the mutual inductance of those coils. I'll just stick to, we can use both in the course, but I'll introduce the main one now, the most important one, the fundamental one. Right, let me look at this circuit. If you imagine trying to drive a signal V1 when this is open circuit over here. If this is open circuit and I2 is zero, what can you say? What does that thing look like to you? Okay, first of all, if I took a pair of pliers and I destroyed the secondary of the transformer so that it was a completely open circuit, and you can never fix it, is the secondary ever going to ever rise to its former power? Is it ever going to have a use ever again? No. Right. I succeeded in destroying it ever. So I get rid of it, and what am I left with? Yes, the self-inductance of the primary circuit is all I have. All right? We're well on our way. V1 equals J omega L1. I won't even assume these have the same self-inductance times I1 plus. Well, we don't have a plus anything. We have zero if I2 is zero. So forget it. But suppose I2 were. I'm using superposition here, right? This is a linear system. So, the current I get, I1, doesn't care about I2, except in as much as it affects V1. So, if now I do have a current I2, forget about it, let's do the reverse. Supposing I go to the secondary now and I destroyed the primary, what would happen then? Same thing, wouldn't it? So, V2 is in fact J omega L2 I2. Now, suppose I never destroyed it. Transformer's quite happy to operate, and the currents are as directed. Who can have the additional terms there? Well, who can tell me what they're going to be? Let M be the mutual inductance. What is it? M, what are those additional terms? J omega M times. So here it's J omega M. J omega M. What goes here? I2, yes. Now you know everything you ever need to know, really, about transformers. But you have to be a little careful about some transformers. For example, you're often led to believe that when all the magnetic flux of one transformer links the other, then M is given by the square root of L1, L2. You can show that's the case. That's where the coupling is unity. In other words, they're one and the same wire. And you can also get a coaxial cable and make a transformer. There's a coaxial cable. The primary is the semiconductor and the secondary is the outer conductor. In that case, this law is very close to true. Because of the symmetry of coaxial cable, the way they're built, the perfect coaxial symmetry between the center and the outer, the mutual coupling is almost one. All that means is that all of the magnetic flux of the primary links the secondary. Okay? Another assumption commonly made about transformers is that mains transformers, for example, often have L1 equal to infinity and L2. Very large inductance. What benefit do you gain from having a big... By the way, the large inductance on a mains transformer, you know, big mains transformers, and they say 1200 kVA and this sort of thing, kilovolt amps, that's their rating, how much power they can transfer, not not dissipate, of course. But why is it that those transformers are big and heavy and have such heavy laminations? It's because they have to have high inductance. Not mutual inductance, that's pretty good anyway. But they have to have high inductance. Why do mains transformers have to have high inductance? It's the only time you ever have to have high inductance in a transformer. All the ones we're going to build will have quite lowish inductance, really. Anyone really know why? Chris, what? Chris, no? No, not Chris. Imagine that this inductance were very, very low, 1 nanometer, and we connected that into a PowerPoint. I'll let you think about it. It's time to go. But it's probably not for a reason. It's not for the proper functioning of the transformer. It's for something else that you put high inductance on a mains transformer. Only one reason. No, nothing to do with capacitance. No, nothing to do with it. Why are those transformers big, heavy, big inductance? Maybe Henry's of inductance. Even some really big mains transformers that you stick across on a power line. Something that's mega VA would have tens of Henry's of inductance, very high inductance. Why do you do that? And it doesn't matter in any other application that I can think of anyway. I'll let you think about that before the tutorial. I'll bring it up again and we can discuss these things in more detail.
Where is the tutorial again?
Where is it? Now it could be, it's supposed to be, I checked it in fact, it's where you said it would be. Say for me what it is so that I can find it on. CCN10A.
CSIT
108, is it?
Yep.
Eight the number. Oh, okay.